Well, thank you so much for inviting me to be here. It sounds like you've had a very rich series so far, looking at the heritage of the Protestant Reformation. And I'm very happy I get to continue with you. Several years ago, I had the chance to visit the city of Bern in Switzerland. Now, in the center of Bern, like in the center of so many European cities, there is a magnificent church. It's an impressive Gothic structure, and it has the most beautiful and valuable collection of stained glass in all of Switzerland. My favorite window in the church is a collection of windows, actually, that depicts something called the Dance of Death. Now, the Dance of Death, a skeleton symbolizing death, comes for people from all walks of life. The version in Bern was designed right around the time of the Protestant Reformation by a man named Nicholas Emmanuel. And Emmanuel's version, death comes for poor laborers, and it comes for kings, for men and for women, for scholars and for soldiers, saints and sinners. Eventually, death comes for everybody. Now, the friend who showed me around this church pointed out that in the bottom corner, Nicholas Emmanuel included a portrait of himself. Death comes for Nicholas Emmanuel. Now, why would he include such an image? Why would anyone want to go to church and look at an image in stained glass depicting their own death? But it seems that at the time, many people wanted to see these sorts of images. It wasn't just stained glass windows. Now, you find the Dance of Death in books and in paintings, frescoes painted on walls. It was even acted out in popular plays all across Europe. It was art with a moral. Now, the point of the Dance of Death was not a kind of Halloween macabre, isn't this horrifying? The point of the Dance of Death was that because death comes for all of us eventually, we should be prepared. It's better to be reminded than to forget, because you can prepare yourself. And that's what Nicholas Emmanuel thought. Now, you might be thinking that we live in a very different age. That's true. Life is less precarious today. Life expectancy is longer. Famine is pretty uncommon, at least in New England. We're unlikely to be attacked by marauding bandits when we take to the road. So maybe the Dance of Death belongs to a different age. Maybe it's too morbid to look at today, but I happen to think there is something profoundly honest about the Dance of Death. Because as grateful as I am for penicillin and for well-stocked supermarkets, I know that the statistic that really matters about death hasn't actually changed. It's still pretty much 100%. And all of those other catastrophes that seem so far off, well, maybe they're not quite so far off as we think. The world we live in is a chaotic and unstable place. If you haven't noticed, our political culture seems to grow angrier by the day. Hurricanes slam into places like Texas and the Caribbean. Thousands of people are going to go to bed in Puerto Rico tonight, not knowing how they'll get food and clean water in the morning. And that's not even to talk about economic collapse, terrorism, or just the daily ordinary sufferings and trials that all of us experience. So how should a Christian face these things? Where is God in a world that seems to be falling apart? Well, this morning we're considering in a series commemorating the Protestant Reformation, and I have been given the task of talking about Ulrich Zwingli. Now, my guess is when this was announced, you scanned through the list of topics, and you probably got pretty excited about Luther. I mean, he's the great man who launched the Reformation, after all, and you probably know his name. Tyndale you might not have known so much about, but once you learn about him, he's one of the most heroic and sympathetic characters of all history, the self-sacrificing genius who gave his life so that even plowboys might read the Bible in English. In fact, probably influenced the English language more than any man who's ever lived, more than Shakespeare. And next week is John Calvin, the greatest theologian of the Protestant tradition. But Zwingli? Who is Zwingli? I mean, what can we say about Ulrich Zwingli? Now, in Sunday school this morning, we talked quite a bit about Zwingli's life and looked at some of the main emphases in his theology. So I'm not going to spend a great deal of time going back over that. But I'll give you a very quick overview for those of you who missed it. Ulrich Zwingli was a Swiss priest who was born just a few months after Luther. And like Luther, he was found himself transformed by his study of the Bible. He eventually became a well-known preacher in Zurich, and he boldly preached directly through the Bible, the New Testament, and then the Old. Through his preaching, Zwingli called the people of Zurich to reject false religion, religion that trusted in human effort and man-made rules. And he often quoted Jesus' words from John 6, "The flesh profiteth nothing. Only the Holy Spirit mattered working in Christians' lives." So he led Zwingli to embrace the biblical gospel. And pretty soon other cities in Switzerland followed, including Bern, where Nicholas Manuel lived. In fact, Manuel became a Protestant and became a good friend of Zwingli's. All of them together believed that mankind could only be justified, made righteous in God's sight through faith and not through works. Now Zwingli died on the battlefield in 1531, swinging an axe in defense of the Protestant cause. So he wasn't really able to finish what he started, but others came after him in Zurich, and indeed around Europe, to pick up where he had left off. And he's worth remembering for his devotion to the Bible and to the gospel of justification by faith. But in my sermon this morning, I don't want to spend very much longer on biography. Rather, I want to look at one of the most important doctrines for Zwingli, and one of the most important doctrines in his teaching and also in his life, the doctrine of providence. Now, providence isn't a word we use very much today. I think it's fallen out of fashion a bit, but it's a word that's worth reclaiming. The doctrine of providence, simply put, is the biblical teaching that God knows everything and is completely in control of everything that happens. So he knows how many hairs are on your head. He determines even when a sparrow will fall to the ground. It even means that God is sovereign over catastrophe and evil. We might think of those words that Joseph spoke in Genesis 50. His brothers had sold him into slavery, and Joseph told them, he said, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." The doctrine of providence says God means it all. He means everything that happens, good and the evil. And he works all of these things together for his own good purpose. Now, this is an eminently biblical doctrine. And it's a doctrine that serves as an anchor for us in the midst of a stormy world. It was an absolutely critical doctrine for Ulrich Zwingli. Now, we're going to look at this doctrine not just because we want to know what Zwingli thought. Rather, we want to use Zwingli as a guide to help us understand God's providence. Now in 1519, the city of Zurich was struck with the plague, the bubonic plague. There were a few things more terrible than the plague in the 16th century. People didn't really have a clear idea about where it came from. There was no germ theory of disease. There were no microscopes. On one day there was no plague, and the next day suddenly there was plague, and thousands could die. In the 14th century, the plague, otherwise known as the Black Death, killed as many as one-third of all the people in Europe. And in Asia, whole villages were depopulated. Now, the plague outbreak that hit Zurich in 1519 was not quite so massive. It didn't spread quite so widely. But in Zurich, it was catastrophic. Around 2,000 people died in Zurich, which was almost a third of the city's population. Zwingli's brother was among the dead. Now, when the plague broke out, Zwingli was actually away. And he heard that the plague had broken out, and instead of staying away where it was safe, he hurried back to town to care for the sick and the dying. Now, this was not the smart thing to do. If you had money, you were supposed to leave, go somewhere safe. But Zwingli wanted to be with his people. Not surprisingly, Zwingli contracted the disease himself and was brought right to the edge of death. Now, Zwingli was a man of remarkable physical courage. He was also, it happens, a very gifted musician. He could play 6 different instruments. As a boy, he had almost become a professional singer. He was recruited because he had such a sweet singing voice. And he also wrote music. And in the midst of this plague, he wrote a hymn, the Plague Hymn. He wrote the first part as he fell ill, and he wrote the last part after he recovered. And I'd like to read part of the Plague Hymn to you. "Help me, O Lord, my strength and rock. Lo, at the door I hear death's knock. Uplift thine arm, once pierced for me, that conquered death and set me free. Yet if thy voice in life's midday recalls my soul, then I obey. In faith and hope earth I resign, secure of heaven, for I am thine. My pains increase, haste to console, for fear and woe seize body and soul. Death is at hand, my senses fail. My tongue is dumb. Now, Christ, prevail. Lo, Satan strains to snatch his prey. I feel his grasp. Must I give way? He harms me not. I fear no loss, for here I lie beneath thy cross. My God, my Lord, healed by thy hand, upon the earth once more I stand. Let sin no more rule over me. My mouth shall sing alone to thee. Though now delayed, my hour will come, involved perchance in deeper gloom, but let it come. With joy I'll rise and bear my yoke straight to the skies. Now, when faced with death, Zwingli didn't flinch. He looked it in the face. And he was able to do that for two reasons. The first was the gospel of Jesus Christ, the good news that Jesus had died for sinners. As a result, Zwingli could sing, "In faith and hope, earth I resign, secure of heaven, for I am thine. I can give up the earth," he says, "because I know I belong to you, and heaven can never be taken from me." Now that is doctrine that sings. In another text, elsewhere, he wrote, "For he who is blameless," that's Christ, "suffered death for us sinners, and paid to obtain for us the wonderful justification of God to which no human can attain. So he has opened up the way to God through his free gift of grace. Whoever hears this and believes without doubt shall be saved. This is the gospel." This gospel gave Zwingli confidence in the face of death. It was the good news that put all the bad news in perspective. That was the first reason. The second reason is the reason I want to talk about primarily this morning, the doctrine of the providence of God. Now, when you listen to Zwingli's plague hymn, you can't help but hear Zwingli's absolute trust that God was in control of his situation. He refused to be overcome by sin, death, or the devil. He was confident, even bold in the face of the plague, because he trusted that God was the king who ruled over sickness as well as health. And even if God chose to take his life, he trusted that it was for the best. So I want to answer two simple questions about providence. And because we're commemorating the Reformation this morning, we'll let Zwingli help us answer them. And the first is just, what do we mean by providence? What is this doctrine? The second is, how does knowing about God's providence actually help us? This is, after all, as Zwingli showed, the most practical of doctrines, the doctrine we must cling to in the face of suffering and danger, as well as prosperity. So let's begin by trying to understand what this word providence means. This is one of the definitions Zwingli gave. He says, "We cannot but admit that not even the least thing takes place unless it is ordered by God. For who has ever been so concerned and curious as to find out how much hair he has on his head? There is no one. God, however, knows the number. Indeed, nothing is too small in us or in any other creature not to be ordered by the all-knowing and all-powerful providence of God." Zwingli taught that there was no part of creation that God did not know. He paid attention to even the smallest details. Of course, in saying this, he's just repeating Jesus' words in Luke 12. "Why, even the hairs of your head are all numbered," Jesus said. So part of the doctrine of providence is God's exhaustive knowledge of everything that happens in the world he's made. That means that God knows the details of your life better than you know them. Can you number the hairs on your head? Now, for a few of you, the answer might be yes. But for most of us, it's far too big of a number. We can't possibly count the hairs on our head, but God knows them. He's not just concerned about the great men and women of history or the cosmic play of the planets in the solar system. No, he's concerned about everything. When Jesus wanted to talk about God's knowledge and governance of creation, he didn't talk about these big things. He talked about the small things, hairs on heads, and little sparrows that fell to the ground. But providence was not just about God's knowledge. It also means that God, the God who formed every part of creation, also governed and ruled that creation. This was true of the natural world. It was true of human beings, things great and small. Zwingli wrote, "Not even the mosquito has its sharp sting and musical hum without God's wisdom, knowledge, and foresight. His wisdom then knows all things even before they exist. His knowledge comprehends all things. His foresight regulates all things." Now, of course, this reminds us that God's providence can at times be mysterious. What is the purpose of a mosquito? I don't know why God permits them to exist, but even their sharp sting has a place in God's plan. The God that Zwingli worshipped was total. He could not be escaped. He could not be ignored. He could not be fenced off in a small corner of your life. Zwingli began his life and his theology with this conviction. God was the creator, but not only the creator. No, he said, through God's power, all things exist, live, and act. God's creation was completely dependent on him, not just for life and salvation, but for its very existence. Now, as you've no doubt figured out, this was not an abstract philosophical question for Zwingli. He says, this is the fountainhead of my religion, to recognize God as the uncreated creator of all things, who solely and alone has all things in his power and freely giveth us all things. It was the source of his entire faith, of his understanding of creation, of his understanding of salvation, from election before time to final redemption. God was in control and would see it through. Now, Zwingli believed that the entire Bible testified to this truth, from the account of the creation in Genesis to the account of the new creation in Revelation. And I don't think you'd have to think very hard to come up with examples of your own where God cares for his people providentially, from the wilderness Exodus to his church in the New Testament. I'd like to look together at one particular text that Zwingli turned to often when he discussed providence. If you have a Bible, turn with me to Acts chapter 17. I checked in the Pew Bibles, that's on page 926. Acts chapter 17. Now in Acts 17, Paul finds himself in the great city of Athens. He'd been preaching in Thessalonica, which is a little farther north in Greece, but an angry mob had driven him away. He'd fled and gone to Berea. He found the people there more receptive to his teaching, more willing to consider it, but the mob followed him and found him there. And so he ended up in Athens waiting for his co-workers, Silas and Timothy. And he did what he normally did. He started preaching in the synagogues and in the marketplace. He started preaching Christ. Look at verse 16. I'll read through verse 28. Now, while Paul was waiting for them, that's Silas and Timothy, at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities, because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection." And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know what these things mean." Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' What therefore you worship is unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods in the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring." Now Paul went on. If you keep reading, you'll see that he called these learned idolaters to repent. He warned them that the time of God's permission of false worship was nearly up. He had fixed a day of judgment, and he was going to judge the world through Jesus Christ. And he had established that fact through the resurrection. But as he strolled through the streets of Athens, Paul found idol after idol, and his spirit was provoked. If you know anything about the religious context of the 16th century in Europe, you can understand why Zwingli might be attracted to this passage. He also felt that he was surrounded by idolatry. All around him were statues and idols designed for worshiping and praying to entities that were not the true God of the Bible. In fact, his followers began tearing down these images in Zurich soon after he began preaching. Paul spoke to these sophisticated pagans about the one true God who does not need anything from us because he made everything. He doesn't need human beings to provide him with shelter or food. He is the very source of life. He's the Lord of history who determines who will live where, when, and for how long. Paul even quotes one of the pagan poets In him we live and move and have our being. Now, if he'd been talking to the Jews, he might have quoted Psalm 139. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. Paul in Acts 17 and the psalmist in 139 were making a profound point. God isn't just powerful and watching. He isn't just the mightiest being in our universe. He is reality in some awesome way. He doesn't live in this universe the way we do. He overshadows it. He fills it and sustains it. The atoms that make up our bodies are knit together because he wills it. And so everything we do is, in that sense, in him. Now, I think it's safe to say that this is a difficult truth to grasp. And it's an even harder thing to live out. We live, actually, as if that the lyrics to that another poem were true. In that poem, Invictus, that you've no doubt heard. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. And that is the reason we are often so prone to anxiety and worry. Because even if we think that we are the captains of our fate, we also know that we're not very skilled captains. And we're almost certainly going to drive our souls upon the rocks. John Calvin, the great reformer who would emerge in Geneva, not far from Zurich, just a few years after Zwingli's death, said we should think often about this truth, in him we live and move and have our being. We should meditate on it constantly so that God might come into our thoughts every moment. The doctrine of providence is a practical doctrine, and it's a call to worship. We are called to marvel at God's wisdom and power. It was false worship that provoked Paul in Acts 17. It's not that the people of Athens were wrong to worship. Worship is essential to all people, but they were worshiping false gods. Anything that we put our trust in, anything we praise and look to for sustenance and protection, other than the one true God, is an idol. And it made no sense to Paul, and it made no sense to Ulrich Zwingli, that people would worship lesser gods when the one true God was so very near to us. In talking about Acts 17, Zwingli said that it wasn't even just people who were God's offspring. He would have liked singing that hymn we sang in the beginning, All Creatures of Our God and King, because all creatures had their birth from God. Zwingli even said that rodents proclaimed God's wisdom and providence. This is what he wrote. The hedgehog, when with its spines he most cleverly carries a large quantity of fruits to its dwelling place, by rolling over the fruit and planting its spines in it, alpine rats or marmots station one of their number upon an elevation, that as they run about intent upon their work, no sudden danger may fall upon them without a cry of warning. And he goes on. Now, I'm not sure Zwingli was quite right in his understanding of animal behavior. I don't know that hedgehogs actually carry fruit around on their spikes. I've never seen it. He actually goes on to describe how squirrels will very cleverly drag wood down to the water and then ride on the wood as a boat using their bushy tails as sails. Now, the Swiss are a very clever people, and it's possible that their squirrels are also cleverer than our squirrels, but I've never seen that happen. But set aside his accuracy on points of zoology, his point still stands. God's creation displays his immense wisdom and knowledge. He displays his perfect control over what he's made. Zwingli said that God sees all things, watches over all things, and loves all things that he has made. So that brings us to our second question. Why does the doctrine of providence matter to us? Let me give you several reasons. The first I've already mentioned, but it's worth revisiting. The doctrine of providence gives us assurance in times of suffering and in the face of evil. I want to acknowledge that the doctrine of providence is difficult in many ways. What does it mean for God to mean evil when he himself cannot sin and is completely pure? I can't answer all of those questions, and I don't think Zwingli could answer them either. In fact, the Bible doesn't ever give a direct answer to that question. It's raised at various points, for instance, in the book of Job, and God's answer is, "Who are you to ask me?" It's a shocking answer. But that doesn't mean God gives us no answer. No, he provides abundant evidence of both his power and his love for us. It's not quite clear how everything in our life lives fits with God's power and love, but we can hardly doubt that it does when we remember that he gave us his only son. If he gave us his only son, will he not also give us all things? The alternative to God's providence, that our suffering is random and purposeless, is horrible and unbiblical. Several years ago, I was visiting an international church in Europe, and the preacher told a story. He had been visiting a church in his hometown in Missouri, and the congregation had Skyped with a missionary in Papua New Guinea. This missionary had just recently been paralyzed in a motorbike accident. The people in the church had tried to encourage the missionary by telling him that God worked all things together for good, that he had some good purpose in this terrible accident. And the pastor of the international church was shocked by that statement. And he said, God didn't mean that. God didn't want that to happen. Now there is, I think, we should recognize a kind of instant comfort in that statement. God didn't want that to happen. It was such a terrible thing. But when you really think about it, there's no comfort in it at all. It means that evil can befall you at any time for no reason at all, and God either can't stop it or doesn't want to. The suffering you're experiencing, it has no purpose at all. It's random. Nothing good is likely to come from it. You could be utterly destroyed, and God will stand by and do nothing. Now that is not the God we read about in the pages of the Bible. It's not the God that Joseph knew, the God that enabled him to say, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. Now, the God of the Bible is in control. This conviction gave Zwingli great courage and confidence in that the gospel would finally be victorious. Now, in truth, Zwingli was sometimes a little overconfident. He could be rash. He died in 1531 in a war fought between Protestants and Catholics in Switzerland, and he had actually encouraged Zurich to go to war, even though they were dramatically outnumbered. Zwingli cited the examples of Joshua and Gideon and said, the Zurichers shouldn't be afraid to fight in God's name. Like most of the other reformers, or for that matter, the Catholics at the same time, Zwingli often forgot that Christ's kingdom does not advance through force and compulsion. In the end, it was actually not Zwingli's war on the battlefield that changed hearts or changed history. It was his preaching of the gospel, his use of the sword of the spirit rather than the sword of the flesh. But even as Zwingli made mistakes, he trusted that God was in control and would win the victory over the forces of false religion. Now, if we're to trust God in difficult times, we must have a trustworthy God, a God who rules and governs with wisdom and love. This is the only source of our comfort. If you are assailed by worry and anxiety, think about this doctrine. Think about God's providence. Zwingli urged Christians to meditate on it. He said, there you will find rest and deliverance from all storms and blasts. He would have urged us to meditate on the power and wisdom of God so that we might stand firm when trials come to face us. So perhaps after the service today, you should read Acts 17 and think about it. Think about the way Paul describes God. Or maybe read Psalm 23, which describes God as a shepherd who always provides and protects his sheep. That is a picture of God's providence. Well, second, providence for Zwingli was a protection against works righteousness. Now, this point might need a little bit more explaining. But Zwingli felt that the doctrine of God's providence totally eliminated the idea that we could do good works that would earn merit in God's sight. Zwingli said, and since all things are done by his, God's activity, how are we to have any merit? That all things are done by his activity was abundantly told in considering him, for in him we live and move and have our being. In other words, we are totally dependent on God for all things. If he is at work through us, then our good works are really his good works. How could we do things God planned and provided for and led us to do and then turn around and claim credit for them? No, the glory belonged to God. This was not a small matter. For Zwingli, like the other reformers, it was important, it was crucial that we understand that we cannot contribute to our own salvation. Salvation is a free gift of God through Christ, and we receive it by faith. If we make it into a work that we have to accomplish through our own effort, grace was lost, and we would fall inevitably into a hypocritical and hopeless legalism. Now, in understanding this point, it helps to understand a little bit about the kind of religion that Zwingli was surrounded by. The Catholicism of Zwingli's day taught that, yes, everyone needed God's grace, but it also taught that you could and should do good works that would count on your own behalf. Catholics believed that after Christians died, they would go to purgatory, and there they would purge themselves of their unpaid debts, of their sins. And the preachers in Zwingli's day loved to describe purgatory. It was a sermon that worked. And early in his career, Zwingli probably preached these kinds of sermons. Purgatory was a place of terrible suffering, a kind of hell. Nobody was quite sure how long you would spend there, but certainly it seemed to be thousands of years. So the thing to do now in this life was chalk up as many good works as you could, accumulate as much merit so that you paid down your debt by the time you died. There was even a kind of accounting that went on. So a visit to a shrine would guarantee you so many years off of purgatory, and they might even give you a piece of paper telling you how many. Zwingli spent several years as the resident preacher at one of the most popular shrines in Switzerland, a place called Einsiedeln, where people would come from all over to pray before an image of the Virgin Mary known as the Black Madonna. Now, people made this journey in part because they wanted to add to the good side of their ledger before they died and went to purgatory. But it wasn't just pilgrimages. The recitation of the right prayer could knock time off. Acts of mercy for the poor would help too. And of course, donating money to the church would always be received gladly and would benefit you when you came to die. In fact, the Catholic Church in the 16th century depended on purgatory to pay its bills. Now, Zwingli and the other Protestants rejected this. It made no sense to them to count righteous deeds this way. In fact, his intellectual hero, the great humanist Desiderius Erasmus, would ridicule those who, quote, measure the length of their time in purgatory as if by water clock, counting centuries, years, months, days, and hours, as though there was a mathematical table to calculate them accurately. No. Erasmus said, and Zwingli said after him, that true piety was a matter of the heart. And the reformers all taught that people were so hopelessly in debt through sin that they could never dig their way out. The only thing that could save was faith in Christ. And so the central teaching of the Reformation was what came to be known as sola fide, faith alone, that we are made righteous in God's sight, not by good works or by centuries spent in torment, but by simple faith in God's promises. We can't even do good works that please God apart from that faith. Zwingli taught that Christ is our righteousness, from which follows that our works, insofar as they are good, so far they are of Christ. But insofar as they are ours, they are neither right or good. Once we understand that everything good in us is a gift from God, we will stop our desperate striving and our arrogant posturing. Now, some of you may come from religious backgrounds that are similar to this medieval Catholicism that I've described. But I think all of us can recognize these same tendencies in ourselves. We want to stand on our own two feet. We want to think of ourselves as basically good and decent people. We want to explain away our misdeeds. I was tired. He provoked me. It wasn't my fault. Everybody does it. We want to explain away our misdeeds, but we never explain away our good deeds. We gladly claim credit for the good we do, even if it's very modest. Zwingli said we got this back. We get this backwards. Our sins are our own, but our good deeds come from God. And so the doctrine of providence teaches us to be humble about our own deeds and always grateful to God. Well, third, Zwingli taught that God's providence secures our salvation. For him, the work of salvation is God's work from beginning to end. God providentially chooses us before creation. He providentially grants faith to us so that we might believe. He providentially preserves us through trials and temptations. Salvation, as much as creation, is God's work. Zwingli said, the whole business of predestination, free will, and merit rests on this matter of providence. So we might ask big questions like, does God choose who he will save? Can we follow Christ according to our own free will? Can we earn merit with good works? For Zwingli, it was crucial that something as important as salvation not be left in weak human hands. We are so prone to stumble. But God's power and wisdom know no bounds. He would see us through. He was the God who, in the words of Jude, is able to keep you from stumbling and to present you blameless before the presence of his glory with great joy. Now, when Zwingli discusses God's providence, he often gets very philosophical. He uses technical language. He cites philosophers like Aristotle. But despite all this, providence for Zwingli was not an abstract academic question. And it shouldn't be an abstract question for us. Does your God reign in the heavens? Does he count the hairs on your head? If not even a sparrow can fall to the ground apart from his will, does that mean that your life is in his hands? Zwingli was willing to give his life to answer yes. Now, the Reformation isn't over. We're just 500 years into it by now. And it's worth remembering great figures like Luther, Zwingli, and Calvin, and all the other heroic men, and actually quite a few women, who helped restore the gospel to the center of the church. But we shouldn't think that the Reformation was something that just these people did. They were joined by thousands, by millions even, of Christians who looked back to the Bible and found this God, the God who justifies sinners by faith and cares for them wisely and lovingly according to his providence. And that's what we'll do if we look for the same.